They told us the streets were paved with gold, and the mother country was our home. We believed them because our school books said so. We packed our lives into cardboard suitcases and boarded ships like the Empire Windrush, leaving the heat of the Caribbean for the grey damp of London and the sharp winds of New York. We were invited. We were needed to rebuild their broken cities and drive their buses. But as soon as we stepped off the gangplank, the invitation felt like a trap. The gold turned to lead. The welcome was a sign in a window that said we didn't belong. We found ourselves caught in a vice between a home that was fading and a host that was hostile. This is the story of the double exclusion. It is the history of how our people learned that the shadow of the empire is long and it is cold. Chapter 1. The Invited Guest. The Caribbean was quiet in the years after the Second World War. The sugar prices were low and the work was hard. When the call came from London and Washington, it sounded like a rescue. They needed hands. They needed nurses. They needed muscle to move the trains and clear the rubble of a war we had helped them win. We were British subjects. We were taught to sing their anthem and speak their tongue. So we went. We sold what little we had to buy a ticket on the ship. We thought we were going home to a place we had only ever seen in pictures. The arrival was the first rupture. The air in England did not feel like home. It felt like a wet blanket. The sky was the color of a bruised plum. Men in sharp suits and women in their best floral dresses stood on the docks of Tilbury, looking for the warmth they were promised. Instead, they found the stare. It was a cold, hard look that said you are here to work, but you are not here to stay. The newspapers called it an influx. They talked about us like a weather pattern or a disease. We were citizens on paper, but on the street we were something else. We were the problem. Finding a place to sleep was the Second War. You would walk down a street in Brixton or Notting Hill and see the signs. No dogs, no Irish, no blacks. It was a rhythmic rejection. Even the people who didn't have signs had excuses. The room was just taken. The neighbors would complain. Our people ended up crowded into damp basements where the walls cried with salt. We shared beds in shifts. One man worked while the other slept. We paid more for the worst rooms because we had no other choice. This was the mother country. She took our labor and gave us a cellar. At work, the exclusion took a different shape. We were overqualified and underpaid. Teachers from Jamaica were told they couldn't teach. Men with trade skills were told to sweep the floors. The unions were not our friends. They saw our dark skin as a threat to the white man's wage. We worked the night shifts and the Sunday shifts. We did the jobs they were too proud to do. We smiled because we had to. We sent money home in blue envelopes because the family was waiting. We didn't tell them about the no black signs. We didn't tell them that the cold wasn't just in the weather. It was in the people. We tried to build our own world within theirs. We started the blues parties because the pubs wouldn't serve us. We started our own churches because the white god seemed to have no room for us in the pews. We ate our food and spoke our talk behind closed doors. But even then, the pressure followed. The police began to patrol our joy. They saw a gathering of black men and saw a riot in the making. They saw our music as a threat to the peace. The tension was building like steam in a pipe with no valve. The dream of the invited guest was dying. We realized we were not there to be part of their society. We were there to be the grease in their machine. They wanted our backs, but they didn't want our faces. They wanted our sweat, but they didn't want our children. We began to look at the suitcases under our beds and wonder if we had made a terrible mistake. But there was no money to go back, and the islands were still poor. We were stuck in the grey, waiting for a sun that never seemed to rise. The silence of the first generation was a survival tactic. They endured the spit on the street and the slurs in the shop so their children could have a better life. They worked three jobs and kept their heads down. They believed that if they were good enough, if they were quiet enough, the country would eventually accept them. They didn't know that the hostility was not a misunderstanding. It was a policy. It was a foundation. The invitation was over, and the eviction was already being planned in the quiet halls of power. The first chapter of our life abroad was a lesson in mirrors. We looked in the mirror and saw a British citizen. The country looked at us and saw an alien. That gap between what we were and what they saw is where the pain lived. It is where the double exclusion began to take root. We were losing our grip on the islands we left behind, and we were being pushed away by the land we stood upon. We were becoming a people of the sea, belonging to neither shore. The sun went down on the 1950s with a bitter chill. The riots in Notting Hill showed that the talk of empire was a lie. The white mobs came with milk bottles and iron bars. They hunted us in the streets while the police looked the other way. We realized then that nobody was coming to save us. We had to save ourselves. We had to fight for the right to even stand on the sidewalk. The invited guest was now the unwanted intruder, and the locks were being changed. Our parents thought the hardship was temporary. They thought the next generation would be seen as equal because they would speak with an English accent. They thought the birth certificate would be a shield. They were wrong. The accent didn't change the color of the skin, and the birth certificate only made the state more determined to prove it was a mistake. The pressure was moving from the docks to the schools and the police stations. The fight was just beginning. As the decade turned, a new law was drafted in the dark. It wasn't about labor anymore. It was about numbers. It was about how to stop more of us from coming, and how to make those already here feel like they should leave. The borders were closing, and the trap was snapping shut. We were in the belly of the beast, and the beast was starting to growl. The ship had sailed, and the return ticket was a dream. We were here to stay, but the land was not ours. The question was no longer how we would fit in. The question was how we would survive a home that hated us. If the mother country was a lie, what was left for us but the fire? Chapter 2. The Fire and the Law. By the 1970s, the silence of our parents was gone. Their children were grown. We were born in the cold, and we didn't have the same patience for the no black signs. We spoke the language perfectly, but the doors were still shut. We were the second generation, a term that felt like a permanent temporary status. We weren't from the islands, but we weren't allowed to be from the city either. We were the youth of the front line. The law became a weapon. They used the Suss Law, a piece of ancient legislation that allowed the police to arrest anyone they suspected of intending to commit a crime. It was a license to hunt. If you were black and you were walking, you were a suspect. If you were standing at a bus stop, you were a suspect. They stopped us, searched us, and humiliated us in front of our neighbors. They wanted us to know that the sidewalk was not our territory. They wanted us to feel the weight of the state every time we stepped outside. In America, the story was the same, but the rhythm was different. Our people moved to Brooklyn and the Bronx, escaping the fallout of colonial rule, only to find the redlining of the American dream. We were packed into projects where the heat didn't work and the sirens never stopped. The civil rights movement was for the black American, but the Caribbean immigrant was often caught in the crossfire. We were too black for the white suburbs and too foreign for the black neighborhoods. We were the outsiders of the outsiders. Back in London, the pressure reached a boiling point in 1981. The New Cross Fire had killed 13 of our children at a birthday party. The police didn't care. The press didn't care. The Queen didn't send a message. To the state, those 13 lives were just a footnote. We realized then that our deaths were as invisible as our lives. We marched in the rain, 20,000 of us, through the heart of London. We called it the Black People's Day of Action. For the first time, they saw our numbers. For the first time, they saw our rage. The riots followed. Brixton, Handsworth, Tottenham, the streets turned to fire. We weren't just fighting the police, we were fighting the feeling of being erased. We threw bricks at the symbols of a system that refused to see us. They called us criminals. They called us thugs. But for those of us on the line, it was the only way to be heard. If the law was a wall, we would burn it down. We wanted the right to breathe without a badge in our face. The institutional racism was not just on the street, it was in the schools. Our children were being labeled as educationally subnormal and sent to schools that taught them nothing. It was a factory for failure. They wanted to ensure that the Caribbean diaspora remained a permanent underclass. We had to build our own Saturday schools. We had to teach our children their own history, because the state was trying to steal their future. We were building a nation within a nation, but as we fought for our place abroad, we started to lose our place at home. When we went back to the islands for a funeral or a wedding, they called us English. They saw our clothes and heard our different vowels and thought we were rich. They didn't see the damp walls of the basement. They didn't see the sus law. We were foreigners in the land of our birth and strangers in the land of our fathers. The double exclusion was complete. We belonged to the journey, and the journey had no destination. The 1990s brought a different kind of mask. They started talking about multiculturalism. They put our faces on the posters for the Olympics. They said the country was a melting pot. It was a lie designed to make the exclusion look like a choice. The systemic violence didn't stop, it just went behind a desk. The resumes with Caribbean names were still thrown in the trash. The glass ceiling was made of reinforced concrete. We were allowed to run for them and sing for them, but we weren't allowed to lead them. The diaspora became a bank for the islands. We sent billions in remittances. We kept the Caribbean economies afloat while we struggled to pay our own rent. We were the heroes of the village back home, but we were the immigrant problem on the evening news in London. We were carrying two worlds on our shoulders, and the weight was starting to crack our bones. We were the bridge that everyone walked on, but nobody wanted to maintain. We looked at the law and saw it shifting again. It wasn't just about stopping people from coming in anymore. It was about finding ways to throw people out. They were tightening the definitions of citizenship. They were creating a hostile environment for anyone who couldn't prove their right to be there with a mountain of paperwork. Many of us had been there for 40 years. We didn't have papers. We had lives. We had children. We had taxes paid. We thought that was enough. The fire of the 80s had cooled into a simmering resentment. We had built businesses and written books. We had changed the music and the food of the world. But we were still looking over our shoulders. The law was still a predator, and we were still the prey. The state was waiting for the right moment to strike. It was waiting for us to grow old and lose our voices. The trap was set. The documents were being shredded. The memory of the invitation was being erased by a bureaucracy that had no soul. We thought the war for our place was over. We didn't know the hardest blow was yet to come. The knock on the door was coming for the elders, and this time, the fire wouldn't be enough to stop it. Chapter 3. The hostile environment. The knock came in the early hours of the morning. It wasn't for the young men on the front line this time. It was for the grandmothers. It was for the men who had driven the buses for 30 years and paid their pensions into the system. The state called it the hostile environment policy. It was a cold, calculated attempt to make life so difficult for illegal residents that they would leave on their own. The problem was, the state decided that anyone who couldn't prove every year of their residence since the 1950s was illegal. The Windrush scandal was not an accident. It was the logical conclusion of 60 years of exclusion. The Home Office had destroyed the landing cards, the very proof our people needed to stay. Then they told us to prove we belonged. People who had lived in England since they were 6 years old were suddenly told they were foreigners. They were denied healthcare. They were fired from their jobs. They were evicted from their homes. Some were snatched from the streets and put on planes to islands they hadn't seen in half a century. This was the ultimate betrayal. We had rebuilt their country. We had given them our youth and our labor. We had endured the No Blacks signs and the Brixton fires. And in the end, they treated us like a used tissue. They waited until we were vulnerable, and then they tried to discard us. The double exclusion was no longer a feeling. It was a government mandate. You are not one of us. You never were. Go back to where you came from. Even if you came from here. The impact on the community was a deep, silent trauma. Men who had worked their whole lives died of stress and broken hearts. Families were torn apart. The fear returned. The same fear our parents felt in the 50s, but worse, because there was no home to go back to. The islands were now tourist destinations where we were just more visitors. If we were deported, we landed in a place where we had no house, no family, and no future. We were ghosts in a tropical paradise. In North America, the exclusion took the form of the deportation machine. Caribbean immigrants who had lived in the US for decades were being rounded up for minor offenses. A decades-old mistake could result in a one-way ticket to Kingston or Port-au-Prince. The state didn't care about the family left behind. It didn't care about the decades of taxes. It only cared about the quota. The diaspora was a harvest, and the season for reaping had arrived. We realized that the American dream and the mother country were both temporary rentals. You could pay the rent for 50 years, but you never owned the keys. The moment the politics changed, the locks were changed too. We were a people living in the meantime. We were always one policy shift away from being erased. This realization changed our music, our literature, and our souls. It turned our identity into a fortress. If the world wouldn't give us a home, we would build one in our heritage. The double exclusion means that when we go to the Caribbean now, we are seen as the rich cousins or the foreigners. We are the ones who left. There is a bitterness there, a sense that we abandoned the struggle on the ground for a life of luxury that doesn't actually exist. They don't see the hostile environment. They only see the remittances. We are caught in a permanent state of longing, longing for a Caribbean that has moved on without us, and longing for a West that will never truly accept us. But in this exclusion, a new power was born. The diaspora became its own nation. We are the people of the third space. We are the bridge between the colonial past and the global future. We created reggae and hip-hop. We created a literature that speaks for the voiceless. We forced the world to reckon with its history. We are the ones who remind the empire of what it did. Our presence is a living archive of the struggle for human dignity. The Windrush scandal eventually forced a public apology. There were speeches in Parliament and promises of compensation, but the money was slow and the apology was hollow. You cannot compensate for the loss of a life's work. You cannot pay for the trauma of being told you don't exist. The scars are still there, etched into the faces of our elders and the hearts of our children. We know now that the apology was just another mask. The exclusion hasn't ended, it has just changed its name. The legacy of the diaspora is a legacy of resilience. We are the ones who survived the cold and the fire. We are the ones who turned the No Black signs into a movement for justice. We are the ones who refused to be erased. The double exclusion tried to make us nothing, but it only made us stronger. It gave us a vision that sees through the lies of nationalism and empire. We know that home is not a piece of paper or a flag. Home is the person standing next to you in the struggle. Our history is not a tragedy. It is a testament. It is the story of how a people, pushed to the edge of every map, decided to draw their own. We are the Caribbean diaspora. We are the citizens of everywhere and nowhere, and we are still here. The wind hasn't blown us away, and the fire hasn't burned us out. We are the roots that grew through the concrete. The story ends not with a resolution, but with a question. As the world moves toward new borders and new walls, where will the diaspora go next? The final line of our history hasn't been written yet, because we are still walking.